You and I back together again for a midweek Wednesday, September 29th, 2021 on Connecticut Today. We welcomed back to the program in the 4 o'clock hour, Dr. Sarah Crawford, a biology professor at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven, to give us the latest and her thoughts on COVID-19, booster shots, and all of that. And I also had a few thoughts as to this continued push by the NLRB to allow unions to represent college athletes. Joining us right now, one of our go-to folks since we started this whole COVID thing about a year and three quarters ago, Dr. Sarah Crawford is a professor of biology at Southern Connecticut State University, and we're going to check in with her right now to, I don't know, get a little COVID-19 update here, see what she thinks about all the numbers, the boosters, and all that. Dr. Crawford, Paul here again. Good to hear from you. How are you?
Very good. How are you, Paul? How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm hanging in. Well, since we last talked, a lot has happened. Give me, Dr. Crawford, your kind of nutshell ascertainment of where we are right now with the virus and with the numbers and the Delta variant, and are we past the peak? Where do you think we stand right now?
Well, I think it is a numbers game, and where we stand depends on where we are. If you're in Connecticut, you're in a pretty good place. If you're in certain parts of the South, you're not in such a good place, or the Midwest. So I think you have to think about the pandemic not only globally in terms of our country and the world, of course, but also in our local area. So around here, things are looking pretty good and very encouraging, and I'm hopeful that in the other parts of the country that aren't doing so well, as the virus continues to spread, it will eventually sort of peter out a little bit and the numbers will go down.
Does the spreading, Dr. Crawford, help in the so-called herd immunity? Is there a plus to be had with this spread if the cases are not fatal?
Well, yes. Everything is perspective when it comes to this. You can take a societal perspective, an individual perspective. On an individual level, you want to see as few people as possible become infected. In terms of the entire society, our culture globally, the more people that are infected and the higher the infectious nature of the virus, the sooner it will come to a close, with everyone either having been infected or, unfortunately in our case, having perhaps had a vaccine, which is available in many parts of the world, although not all parts of the world, and then you see eventually a decline. But the question is, what is your vantage point? From an individual point of view, I think you should want to do everything possible to prevent yourself and people that you know from getting infected.
Dr. Sarah Crawford is the guest. Dr. Crawford, hang on. We'll be right back with you. More of a checkup and a chat regarding COVID-19. First, traffic and weather together. 4:36 coming up on WICC. At 4:40, just 6 minutes away from another check of traffic and weather together, getting a COVID-19 checkup, if you will, from Professor Sarah Crawford. Dr. Crawford, who's a professor of biology at Southern Connecticut State University. Professor Crawford, what was your general feeling on the guidance and the votes recently regarding the booster shots for COVID-19, many of which have now been given in the state and around the country already? What'd you think of the whole booster shot debate here?
Well, I think it's complex because it's multi-layered. I think for people who are clearly at risk for COVID infection, side effects or really serious consequences, there's no question that a booster is in order. But I think that there were very limited clinical trials in terms of the number of enrolled individuals. So we really don't know what the numbers are, what the stats are, and, you know, whether it's really necessary or whether there is a need for this elevated level of protection. So I think that, yes, if you're in a high-risk group in terms of age or immunocompromised, it certainly is a good idea. I would think you should check with your doctor, of course. But I think for the general public, I think the answer is not in yet. And I think it's created a lot of confusion, unfortunately, because we don't have enough data, not enough clinical trials, not enough communication as to what's going on. And we have some of this serving as ammunition for the anti-vaxxers who are saying, you see, the first two didn't work if you need another one. So it's a very complicated situation. And I think each person has to sit down very carefully and think about what their risk-benefit situation is. And keep in mind, it's only available right now for people who have had the Pfizer as an original vaccine.
Stripping away, Dr. Crawford, as you say, the anti-vaxxers, the pro-vaxxers, all the political stuff around this, from a purely epidemiological nuts and bolts standpoint, can you have too many booster shots? Can you be, is it possible to be doing this too quickly in such a way that the virus becomes more resistant from a nuts and bolts level?
Well, I don't think it has a direct impact on the virus, quite frankly. I think that as long as the booster is providing protection against infection, then that's a good thing. But I will say that people who have had the vaccine, protection against infection itself has gone down, which means that you can become infected but not really get sick and still transmit the virus. So from an epidemiological point of view, right now the booster would make sense because it would help you to prevent you from becoming infected at all, which overall would have a good effect on the virus making its way from person to person. But I think the issues are far more complex than that. And I think we always have to keep in mind that we have a lot of people in our community, including children, at risk and health workers at risk. And the question is, what is the best decision in terms of the booster? And I think the answer is really not clear at this point.
One of the fascinating things, Dr. Crawford, that I see, and undoubtedly you read about numerous times every day in your line of work, is all these competing studies that come out. And, you know, I think this helps kind of ferment a little bit, as you say, of the confusion among people, or, you know, fuel some of the political rhetoric about this. One day we say, oh, okay, the Moderna is better long term. And then we say, and then we see a study that says, oh, no, but, you know, Israel or somebody says the Pfizer is better. And then there's the J&J. Hey, it's only one shot, but look how good we are. Boy, it can get really... it can really make people glassy-eyed, can it? If they just get too much of this information, can it?
Well, that's the downside of all of this. First of all, some of it is unavoidable. I mean, this pandemic unfortunately caught us off guard, and so we've been scrambling to try to deal with it. And I think overall we've done a good job as a global community, although there are significant gaps internationally. But I think that inevitably that's going to create a lot of data flying by and people trying to pick it out and figure out what's right, what's wrong. Then you have all the political perspectives that had been superimposed on this. And I do think that in trying to stay ahead of the pandemic, that some of the government agencies have been a little bit short on data and cohesiveness in terms of the message. Mm-hmm. And this has help to foment the confusion, unfortunately, because this is a very serious issue that still affects all of us.
You know, finally, Dr. Crawford, it's funny you say that, because I have said on this show, and I don't mean this to be tongue-in-cheek, but I think there are talking heads on all the news channels all the time, especially on the weekends. And you're right. If one person says something that's even mildly contradicting the other from the NIH or the CDC or some prominent university, I do think, although it's everybody is doing this stuff with good intentions, it does kind of give people a little weariness, even though this is a very significant issue.
Yes, I agree. I honestly think that maybe some of the public officials should be a little bit more forthright. Maybe sometimes we should say, we don't know. We're checking it. We're not exactly sure whether you should be doing X or Y. We're going to have more data soon. I think this sort of faux confidence that's portrayed at some levels of the academic elite, so to speak, is a little bit disconcerting to the general public, because you can see through the uncertainty that underlies all of this. I think we need honest discussion. We need the truth. We need real data. And we need to inform people that at the end of the day, each of us has to make a private decision as to what's best for us and our families.
Dr. Sarah Crawford, couldn't agree with you more. Professor of Biology, Southern Connecticut State University. Good to talk with you again. We'll check in down the road. Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Thanks. Thanks. Bye-bye. There you go. Well, and again, I've been saying the exact same thing Dr. Crawford said there. You know, let's not, again, and you know one of my favorite phrases on this show, folks, what it is, whether it's COVID, whether it's the environment, whether it's science or whatever, you know, we don't know it all. And I think Dr. Crawford hit it on the head there. It's okay to say we think, we're not sure, could be, maybe. I think more people will be comfortable with that versus, well, another month or two. Remember at the beginning, and it did happen to a point. Remember that? It's a month. We'll flatten the curve in a month and everything will be fine. Well, you know, I hearken back to something I read about a year and a half ago at the beginning of this thing. Some virologist from Harvard or Yale or Columbia basically said there was a piece in the Hill where they said, look, about 90% of the world is eventually going to get this. So let's cross our fingers that it doesn't kill a whole lot of people. And I'm not being flip here, but that's what this gentleman or this woman's point of view was. They said, look, I've been studying this thing for 30, 40 years. Yeah, we're going to try real hard, but millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of people are going to get this. And let's cross our fingers. Let's talk about unions, shall we? And let's talk about the place, or as I like to consider, the no need, the lack of a need for such in college athletics. I'm not talking about the pros. I'm not talking about the NBA or the NHL or Major League Baseball or, you know, the NFL. I'm talking about college athletics. And just up front, to be completely honest with you, I have mixed feelings about unions. Private sector unions, I have no problem with. I have less than zero of a problem with EABC Steel Company having a unionized workforce. And they negotiate a fair wage based on the, and other things with the company, based on the profitability of the company, based on how good the company has done, how the company wants to expand, whether they're affiliating with other companies, whatever. You know what I mean. So private sector unions, whether it's the big three automakers, whether it's a small unionized machine shop, whatever, restaurant unions, unions with major corporations, I got no problem with that. I have a problem with government unions. I do, I'm sorry, either state government or municipal government. Not because I think the people are bad people. No, I understand that. They want to get what they want to get. I get it. But in that case, the taxpayers always foot the bill. They always foot the bill. It's the nature of a civil service union. Who pays for it? Well, you know, at least in the private sector unions, companies have the freedom to or not to raise or lower their prices to cover their labor costs, and people have the freedom to shop around. When you have municipal unions, well, guess what? In the end, the taxpayer is going to pay. Okay, those are discussions for another day. And just to be, you know, fully transparent here, I used to belong to a broadcast union. If I had to join a broadcast union again, I would. No questions asked. My son's in a major union. I have friends of mine who are in the same union. But where unions do not belong, where they do not belong, is college athletics. This has been pushed for years, and this story came out today. This version from USA Today, the National Labor Relations Board's General Counsel, today issued a memorandum that says she views college athletes as employees of their schools under the National Labor Relations Act. Man, the union honchos, they licking their chops now. The move sets the stage for a renewal of efforts to organize college athletes. Most likely football or men's basketball at private schools into unionized collective bargaining units that could seek to set various working conditions, including compensation. Folks, the union, man, the unions are going, look at this. Man, they can't wait. They can't wait for four years for these men and women athletes to get out of school. They got to unionize them now. Such an effort occurred back in 2014 and 2015 with football players at Northwestern University, but that ended, remember this? When the NLRB unanimously decided in August 2015 not to accept jurisdiction over the matter. But who's in office now? Oh, labor, yes. This is one of the most idiotic things I've read in a week. Can you give me one good reason why college athletes should be in a trade union? Go ahead. 203-333-9422. 203-333-WICC. Can you give me one solitary good reason why college athletes who are on scholarship, I'm not talking about non-scholarship now, you're on a scholarship. So at most decent public and private universities in this country, you know what a four-year scholarship costs? Now, my son just got out of school a couple of years ago. You folks who have kids in school or, you know, are going to in a few years or have grandkids or whatever that went out, you know, it's $200, $225, $240, $250,000 plus added costs, which if an athlete is on scholarship, on an athletic scholarship, they get that free. Well, Paul, these student athletes, you know, they should be compensated. They are getting compensated. They're getting a free education. Well, that's not compensation. The hell it isn't. You've got four-year colleges now. I mean, my alma mater, I talked to a young woman a few months ago. I went to Boston University. She was telling me that there's very little financial aid given out anymore. So if you're not on scholarship there, you know, BU is, you know, 60 grand a year, 63, 65 grand a year. Well, but if you're on an athletic scholarship, mom and dad just saved $250,000. And good for you. There's nothing wrong with that. But the unions now, they got to come in there and they got to enroll students. Folks, I'm telling you, there is less than zero good reason for college athletes to be in labor unions. This is nothing more than the labor movement saying, oh, you know what, a lot of these college guys and gals, when they get out, they won't even consider a union, so let's jump on them now. Because I dare you, go ahead, give me a call, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. You tell me, okay, you tell me why college athletes at UConn or Yale, or Sacred Heart, or Fairfield, or Wesleyan, or Quinnipiac, why they should be in a union. God, you can't let them go for 4 years and just relax and be a young adult. You got to be like buzzards over the carcass, you union people, huh? I'm sorry. I know you hate the unions. No, I just said before we started this, I don't hate unions. I don't. But you know what? Time and a place. I'm sorry. Time and a place. Well, you know, Paul, when they play, they make big money for these schools. Well, welcome to America. Because guess what? After they get out of that school and they don't go to the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, Major League Baseball, MLS, whatever, play in Europe, guess what? They're going to have to switch gears and do something that, guess what, is going to make billion-dollar corporations money. They may be a junior accountant, a junior broker, whatever, junior lawyer here and there. Well, you know what? When you're in college and you're doing that for your school to, you know, bolster the endowment, you got a four-year head start. So this is pure, unadulterated lunacy. In fact, one of the people who was instrumental in this saying, said today, well, you know, the notion of a student athlete, that's, that really doesn't apply here. See, what they're trying to do, kids, is they change the verbiage. Remember, words mean things. So they change the verbiage here. But go ahead, I'll dare you. You try, you tell me. Give me one solid, logical reason, other than politics. Give me one solid, logical, well-thought-out reason why college athletes should be represented by trade unions or professional unions.